Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It is one of the most talked about articles of the year. A piece for Vanity Fair titled, Inside the New Right, where Peter Thiel is placing his biggest bets. The article features figures like J.D. Vance and Blake Masters. And it may hold the key to unlocking the future of conservative politics. So why has this article resonated, and what does the author think we all need to know? Those are some of the questions for this week's Reliable Sources podcast. Let's cue the music. I'm Brian Stelter, and this weekly podcast is our chance to go in depth with media leaders and newsmakers, talking about the story behind the story. And that's exactly what James Pogue was able to get at through his reporting about the new right, or the so-called red-pilled right. He described a conference called NatCon, which he says has grown into a big tent gathering for a whole range of people who want to push the American right in a more economically populist, culturally conservative, assertively nationalist direction. Pogue was able to gain really unique access to some of these key figures. And he was given the time and the space by Vanity Fair to tell a complete story, one that you rarely hear during political punditry about Donald Trump or the Republican Party. No, what Pogue gets at is something deeper and newer. Pogue is a contributing editor at Harper's. He's the author of a book called Chosen Country, Rebellion in the West. And let's get to him. James Pogue joins me now. And James Pogue, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I'd love to start with your bio, your background. What led you to this world and this beat? Tell us about what you've written over the years and what led you to this spot.
So I've covered kind of the American right and militias and things like that, particularly in the rural West, for most of my career. I started by reporting on the Bundy-led takeover of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon back in January 2016. And so I wrote a book about that was very much about a kind of what you might think of as a libertarian right, a right that was, on the one hand, you know, very interested in sort of rural working class politics, but also that was very much in line with a libertarian, like kind of attack big government, right-wing corporatist vision of what it meant to be conservative in America. And that over the time that I've covered that has changed a lot. It's become, as I think a lot of people have seen, it's become much more of a kind of nationalists versus globalist thing. And so I am from Cincinnati, as is J.D. Vance. And when he announced his run for Senate, I thought he was really interesting because I thought he was representative on some level of something that was happening on the right that I thought a lot of people didn't understand. And JD and I both grew up in kind of Appalachian inflected communities in Cincinnati, communities of people who had left rural Appalachia and come to the big city, but retained a certain, what you might call identity coming from that region. And so we had a background in common, and I reached out to him and asked if we could meet at a diner. It was the same, you know, it's a place he frequents. It's a place I frequented when I was a kid. And when I met him, I discovered that he really was representative of a much bigger movement than I was even kind of conscious of existing on the American right, which surprised me because I cover it.
Right. I mean, you've been covering this for years. The book I mentioned, Chosen Country, that came out in 2018. Your expose of a homegrown American militia movement. So this has been on your radar for a while. What is the untold story of Amon Bundy and what happened there in Oregon? I mean, to me, it was a blip on the radar. It was one of those stories that was hot for a few days. We covered it on TV and then we moved on. But that's, of course, sometimes part of the problem. there's something much bigger there. So what to you was the untold story of Ammon Bundy? And then we can talk about whether that connects to the J.D. Vances of the world.
Oh, I think it definitely does connect. So what I have started to learn, I live in the rural West at the moment. I've been on and off in the rural West for a long time, is that there's a very, very deep sense of alienation coming from people who are on the right, who have started to get a sense that corporate America, liberal America, the institutions that a lot of us, you might say, participate in and believe in, and that goes very deep. That goes to academia, it goes to everywhere from the New York Times to institutions that a lot of us don't even really think about, like our NGO system and things like this. I started to learn that people like Ammon were very opposed to the structures that go far beyond the kind of anti-government label, and that people were very, very alienated even from the Republican Party, even though they didn't really have at the time a way of expressing a conservative politics that went against the Republican establishment. And that's something that, you know, where I live now, this is going a little bit afield, but where I live now, there's a war within the Republican Party, much like the war that's happening in the National Republican Party, where you have a conservative activists who call themselves working class, who kind of believe in a reshaping of American life towards a kind of middle America that they feel like is lost, who are doing a total insurgency against the government here. And I started to get a sense with Ammon that that was the bigger story that was going on in rural politics. And that I tend to think is something that's reshaping national politics as well.
Right. So the politics, the phenomenon you're describing, has relatively little to do with Donald Trump, who has been the dominant name, figure, icon of Republican politics for the last 6 years. It's what the media, if you boil down the national media's coverage of GOP politics into two words, the words would be Donald Trump. But what you're describing in the rural West is not very Trumpy at all.
No, and I think that actually the bigger national story that a lot of people are missing is that Donald Trump, for a lot of people, was somebody who came in and he messed stuff up, and they really, really liked that. And he was someone who came in, and this is a kind of subtle and difficult thing to explain sometimes, but we live in America generally with a story that everything is getting constantly better, that economic progress is constantly improving our lives, that technology is irresistible and is always moving forward, always improving human life. And a lot of people in America actually don't agree with that story. And Donald Trump, even though he didn't really say it, he kind of came in and he smashed stuff up and he broke up that story of progress. He said America actually isn't getting better. It was better back in the day. That's the sort of sense of the Make America Great Again slogan. And what I've started to notice is that slowly you're building a politics around these critiques of progress, these critiques of a society that's always moving forward for the better. And that's very much at the core of a lot of rural politics, but it's also at the core of the new right.
Yeah, that's fascinating. But it's something that I perceive to be happening underneath the radar of the national media. It sounds like you would share that critique.
Absolutely. And I think that when people miss that, when people make it all about the figure of Donald Trump, you create a thing where, I don't mean you personally, I mean all of us who are involved in this, kind of create a circumstance under which Donald Trump becomes a figure of unique evil. He becomes a figure of kind of obsession, not just for the left, but also for the right, because people flock to him to kind of defend the person of Donald Trump, the great hero. But actually there's something much deeper going on that he's representing that I think a lot of people are missing.
Yeah, it's really interesting how that sense of decline of America not improving, it's an animating force both on the left and on the right. And on the right, one of the ways it takes shape is through this politics of rebellion of, well, describe more for us what you're covering there in your proverbial backyard. What's been going on there?
So here, I mean, this sounds actually very crazy to describe, even though it's normal politics here. Here, the militia just took control of Shasta County, which is a county that encompasses Redding, California, in this region that's often known as the State of Jefferson, which is historically a kind of, people call it a rugged individualist state, even though it's not really a state. It's a kind of like vision. It's a place where people envision themselves as separate from the run of metropolitan urban California. So I'm in far northern California.
To be clear, it is run by the state of California, right?
It is run by the state of California, but
you still pay California taxes.
You very much do. But interestingly enough, the kind of the authority of the state of California is seeming to break down here a little bit. And so, you know, you had open and complete COVID defiance here. You also have a kind of a politics that connects very much to a national trend where people have started to fight a civil war within the Republican Party. The militia here ran candidates as sort of proxies in a recall election, and they got one person elected that gave them a three-person majority on the board. And I bring this up because it goes back to something, you know, here, economic inequality used to not really be much of a thing. Now it's very, very, very present. And there's a kind of anti-elite, anti-corporate movement that is shaping up amongst the kind of counties, former loggers, former ranchers, people who have lost certain ways of life that they feel like they need to do something to bring back. And it's not really clear that it's possible because there's a huge number of federal regulations and economic forces far beyond anything that's happening in this county that would prevent that. But people really mm-hmm. want to bring back a logging economy, a farming economy, a kind of rural landed, almost like Jeffersonian vision of America. And increasingly, they're willing to pick up guns to fight for that.
And do you consider what's happening there part of the new right, the same new right that you described for Vanity Fair?
Well, it's definitely a part of a trend on the entire global right, where you're seeing what you might think of as the energy in conservative politics shifting away from pro-corporate, pro-ultra-capitalist, you know, kind of libertarian politics towards something that, you know, as you see in France, a right that is nationalist, theoretically pro-worker, things like that. It's very much a part of that broader, what you might think of as new conservatism that is sweeping the Western world. What's funny is that I'm not sure people are actually aware here that there even is a new right, but they're kind of acting out the same trends on a very local scale, almost organically.
I see. So let's talk about the larger trend, the one that you received so much praise for your writing in Vanity Fair. It's been striking to me how this article you've written has had a long tail. People talking about it weeks now, at this point, months later. I've heard a lot of different people try to summarize it. People will say it's about the red-pilled right or again, new right. Just give us your initial pitch to your editor. You know, what were you trying to write about here?
So that's funny that you asked that. My pitch was essentially a kind of attempt for myself to understand what was going on. So my editor had asked me to write about J.D. Vance, and I, you know, being from Cincinnati, being pretty similar in age to him, I had already written one piece about him. And I just felt uncomfortable being the guy who describes J.D. Vance to the world. I just didn't want to do that. and it kind of hurt my pride in a certain way. And so I, when I met J.D., he started using these terms like the regime and, you know, kind of the cathedral and things that appear in the piece that are very kind of weird terms that I had never personally heard. And so my pitch was, hey, let me try to describe the ecosystem that is shaping him, because there's something bigger going on here that I don't personally understand. And to their great credit, they kind of just gave me a writ to go and figure it out. And we didn't have a reporting plan. We didn't know that I was going to go to this thing, the National Conservatism Conference. They just said, sure, go figure it out and describe us an ecosystem and we'll see what happens.
That's awesome. That sounds like every writer's dream.
Very much. I mean, and it's every writer's dream. I turned this piece in at 14,000 words. And it's every writer's dream to have an editor that actually will work with that instead of killing the piece on site. And so they were great. I mean, they really went with it. And they tried to do their best, you know.
And when you were working on this, again, last year, J.D. Vance was a Senate candidate. He's now the Republican nominee in Ohio. But we didn't know how relevant he was going to be. We didn't know. For a while, it looked like he was an also-ran in that race, if I remember correctly. So you were in on kind of a ground floor, so to speak. How important was it to have access to Vance for this?
It was very important. And, you know, I kept jumping in there just because it shocked me a little bit and gratified this whole kind of year I've spent reporting on this stuff. Because when I met him, I had the immediate reaction, this is a person who is trying to reshape American politics. And this is a person who has a lot of backing and a lot of people kind of under the radar who really, really care that he wins. And, you know, that, like, I can tell you for absolute certain, you know, that Tucker Carlson was pumping for JD on a level that probably we haven't seen for a lot of candidates ever in the history of kind of cable news era.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously this comes up in the piece a lot, but Peter Thiel gave him millions of dollars. And beyond that, there's a whole ecosystem of media, magazines, a whole corner of the internet that viewed JD as one of their own and really, really, really wanted to get him in there because he is, as we talked about before, he is not, the person he presents necessarily. He is not this kind of like MAGA, you know, ultra Donald Trump loyalist as he often plays on TV. He is someone who is coming out of this reshaping of the American right and who is probably its first champion. And so without him, I don't think I could have reported this. I don't even think I would have realized it was happening until I met him when he was down at 7% in the polls. And I was lucky a little bit to see that he was actually going to go and get this nomination, which I thought he always was.
Oh, you did? You thought he always would win?
I was sure of it.
Why?
Well, okay. So my theory was that he had backers in the media. He had backers at high levels who cared more than you could possibly care. You know, I'm from Ohio. I know these people. This won't be interesting. But, you know, Josh Mandel is one of the slimiest people who has ever entered Ohio politics. And he made the Trump transition just as everybody else in the Republican Party did because it was convenient, because he kind of saw where the writing was and he saw, hey, okay, this is going to work for me electorally. JD, their opponent, had an ecosystem of people who view him as the first step in a beachhead for a war for the soul of the Republican Party. That's different. You have a level of loyalty and care there that was very, very intense. And to go beyond that, I was always convinced that Peter Thiel was going to be able to convince Donald Trump to endorse him. And because the big knock against JD in this primary was that JD had said bad things about Trump, the Trump endorsement was going to always mean much more in Ohio than it might have in Georgia or something. So I was convinced that endorsement was going to happen and that it was going to put him over the top.
All right. So your calculations were correct.
For once.
But it's because Vance is this vessel for something much, much bigger than him. So again, what is it? Let's try to get, what I keep trying to get at. What is this?
Okay. So Vance is a good illustration of this. So on the one hand, you have kind of at the more public end of this stuff, you have an attempt to reshape the Republican Party along the lines of a nationalist, kind of conservative values first politics that is very similar to, if anybody follows, you know, the French right, that is very similar to what Marine Le Pen has done on the French right. A kind of nationalist, pro-worker, non-libertarian, you know, pro-government in many ways, but authoritarian vision of Republican politics. That's part of it. The other part of it is, as we talked about before, this kind of critique of progress and this kind of new intellectual ferment that is shaping up, especially on Twitter, essentially, that people call the dissident right. And the dissident right now, you know, it has a whole ecosystem of magazines, anywhere from the American Conservative to this new thing called Compact, to another called IM 1776 that just produced its first like literary and art journal. So they're kind of recreating the intellectual world that once was, you know, often thought of as the province of the left. And this kind of end of it is very much a kind of intellectual ecosystem that is trying to look beyond liberalism and these stories of progress, that is trying to figure out what happens when the American government falls. And a lot of people already think that that's going to happen. And a lot of people are looking towards these kind of, you know, Caesarian versions of what happened when the Roman Empire fell, and looking for people who are going to take over and take power and reshape America in very broad ways. And a lot of people think that JD might be that person.
And when you're listening to all of this and soaking it all up, does it sound to you like a plot from some sort of wild HBO drama, or does it sound plausible?
Well, the thing that makes it plausible, so their big critique is that this thing called state capacity in America, our ability to kind of effectively do stuff, whether it's from, you know, coming from the liberal side of things, like our ability to effectively address climate change or something, all the way on the conservative end to our ability to, you know, some of these people want to ban porn, for example. Basically, none of that can happen because our government is so divided, so broken down, so consumed with lobbying power that nothing really seems to get done these days, right? And their critiques are about how to re-centralize power into the executive so that you can do big things very quickly again. And the reason it feels plausible to me and not like some kind of crazy plot is that if we don't get government working again on some level, somebody is going to come in and do something very authoritarian because our society is in many levels breaking down. And so I actually do think that it's something that leftists should take very, very serious look at, because we have to figure out a way to get our government moving again. And if we don't, I think these critiques coming from the right are going to be very salient and very powerful in coming years.
Mm. And that antagonism for democracy and that reactionary politics will draw more attention. That democracy point, we say authoritarianism. When we talk about, you know, there's words in your article like dictator, although some of these folks have backed away from that term. Was this very open and public, you know? Because when we say authoritarianism on CNN, there's a sense of, those are the bad guys, right? But it sounds like you were inside a world where it wasn't viewed that way.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, so this runs the gamut. So JD will talk about very, very serious things. He will talk about publicly, he will talk about firing every single member of the federal bureaucracy and replacing them, quote, with our people. And then when he gets sued, he will talk about, and he'll say this openly, that whoever's in charge, ideally someone on his side, will just defy the Supreme Court, defy lawsuits, and make that happen. So a real kind of, you know, they call it a constitutional coup. People talk about that very openly. People use the word extra constitutional. That's very much a part of current kind of trendy right-wing thinking. Then you get even farther, though, and there are magazines like, there's this new magazine called Palladium that basically just doesn't even deal with contemporary politics. They just sort of assume that the structures of American power are going to fall in organically almost, and are thinking about entirely new and weird systems. And so you hear a lot of people talking about monarchy. You hear a lot of people talking about the kind of Roman Republic and this idea that there was so much chaos that inevitably a dictator or a monarch or an emperor was going to step in. And that talk is, broadly speaking, they're talking about it favorably. I mean, they're very interested in this stuff.
Right. I think that this is, again, where it sometimes is missed by the national media. There was certainly a focus on Donald Trump and his authoritarian impulses, and often his ineffectiveness at doing what he wanted with the government. But that was very much like a 2018, 2019 story. And you seem to be covering the 2023, 2024 story, if I may say, which is where we're heading. So use a couple of terms that I think we should define: the regime and the cathedral. And folks who've read the article, you get this, but even so, let's elaborate on it. I've heard regime used a lot in right-wing media in the last year to describe Biden. It's a way of insulting Biden or throwing dirt. You know, regime, they're the Biden regime. But the use of regime that you were hearing by the Vances of the world, tell me if I'm wrong, it was something bigger and different.
Definitely. And I would caution people, if you do, you know, if you do turn on Tucker or Laura Ingraham or something and you hear the word regime, it's easy to think that they're talking about, you know, kind of the federal government. I would tend to think, in my experience, even kind of in the national media, when they're using that term, they are using it in a much broader sense. So Dady told me that he views the regime, and this is a very weird thing, he views the regime as the set of people in America, the 20 or so percent of America, that wants to get its kids into elite Ivy League schools. And so he views it as a kind of cultural phenomenon. And this is something that comes from kind of the deeper currents of the online right, where the regime is not just the federal government, because they view the federal government as actually, as we talked about, not really having that much organic power. So you will hear people talk about the New York Times as a kind of fourth branch of government. You will hear people talk about Harvard and Yale as centers of power. You will hear people talk about, like, the Southern Poverty Law Center as almost like an intelligence gathering arm of the federal government. So they view the regime as a kind of distributed power structure that is staffed by elite, liberal, college-educated people. And it's kind of like the easiest way to understand it is sort of to think of the Soviet regime. You had a Politburo, you had a set of people who were very high up who actually ran the government, but you also had millions of people who were members of the Soviet Communist Party, right? And when people are talking about the regime, they're talking about all of the people who theoretically in America have a little card that puts them in the elite, right? And they're trying to topple that whole system. And so, like, you know, for example, part of why Hungary is so, so interesting to people there is that Viktor Orban didn't just seize the levers of government. He reshaped how media worked. He reshaped how NGOs operate in the country. He attacked George Soros. He kind of put his people in charge. And I'm not an expert on Hungary, but my understanding is he put people who were close to him, who had conservative values, in charge of large kind of media companies. So he distributed power in the way that these people see the regime as distributing power throughout the United States. And they want to kind of relocalize that so you can get power back for the New York Times and put it back in the government. And I know this is a long answer, but this all kind of connects to Donald Trump, because people looked at Trump in 2016 and hoped that he might be a vessel for them to kind of accomplish some of this. And Trump just wasn't that interested and frankly didn't really understand, I think, a lot of what people were trying to get him to do. I think the next go around, these attempts are going to be much more serious and they're going to be much more planned out, and they're going to kind of probably reshape our politics in meaningful ways that we're not quite ready for.
If Trump was about words, the next is about actions, I think is one of the possibilities.
Absolutely.
But what you're saying helps me understand the insults that come my way, just as one tiny little example of this at CNN, because CNN is part of the traditional media, right? That thus I'm a member of what they're describing, because so I'll get messages that'll say things like, well, there's a coordinated campaign here. Clearly you and Democratic operatives have worked together on a coordinated campaign to cover this story. And you know, so Stelter here is sitting in my basement and hearing that thinks, well, I didn't talk to any Democrats before my show. I didn't talk to any progressive lobbyists before my show. But in the minds of the advances of the world, it's all of a piece, right? It's all of a regime.
Absolutely.
And I have to say, I'm listening to you and I'm trying to find a way to connect to that theory or that thought process. And I'm having a very hard time doing it. I'm having a very hard time relating to that dystopian, or I don't know what is the right word for it? Is it dystopian or is it something different?
Oh, I think dystopian is, yeah, I think dystopian is exactly the right word. I think a lot of people on the new right very much view us as living in a dystopia for a number of reasons, and for a number of reasons that people on the left would probably share, kind of ideas that tech and media are controlling our brains and addicting us to things and stuff like that. But, you know, going to your point, like as a fellow member of the regime media in theory, it took me a minute to try to understand this too. And I think the key is that people who are viewing this movement from the outside often think that this is all a theory, that there's a plot, that there's a conspiracy, this sort of thing. And actually the new right has developed a theory that is basically that there is no conspiracy. There is no plan. There are no wires. Like, I don't think JD would expect you to be communicating with Democratic operatives. What he's saying is that there are incentives in our cultural sphere of this quote unquote regime that cause people to act out its political imperatives, even though they don't know that they're doing that. And so they kind of think of liberalism as a kind of brainwash, like soup that people are swimming in that kind of shapes their behavior and causes them to try to get status within this system, even though they don't know what they're doing, even though no one's giving them orders. And that is new. It's not like QAnon. It's like a totally new way of describing why people in media and government behave the way they do.
Right. I mean, we are 5 years out from Trump calling the media the enemy of the people. And that sounds quaint compared to what you're describing. So phrases like the Matrix, the Ministry of Truth, the regime, this is what comes up again and again as you're doing your reporting. And the other one is the cathedral. Can you unpack that one for us?
Yeah, I will try. So the cathedral is a kind of signature concept of this guy, Curtis Yarvin, who is probably the most significant living thinker on the new right. He's in many ways repurposing, conservative and right-wing thought that has been to some degree buried for a long time, at least from national view. But Yarvin has elaborated a number of concepts. He was the first person to really popularize the term red pill. And I talk about this in the piece, but, you know, we use red pill often just as a way of describing somebody who's been red-pilled and has turned right-wing. But to Yarvin, what red-pilled means is that you have woken up to a media ecosystem that is basically controlling how you think and behave. And so he's saying that essentially, you know, our global elites, our aristocracy that he views as shaping this world, the kind of Davos people, as often people describe here, people who are participate at high levels in corporate and NGO structures. He basically views them as having an incentive to forever produce a new corporate capitalism that's always bringing the world into closer globalized consumerist kind of dystopia or whatever you want to call it. And he thinks that institutions like CNN are basically cheerleading for that because they are incentivized to participate in this structure that produces wealth, that gives people power. And so whenever conservatives resist this, they get mocked, attacked, people investigate them, this sort of thing. The cathedral, as you might think, kind of leveraged itself to attack Donald Trump. That's a big thing here. And so it's this decentralized system of media and government and especially academics who kind of produce thought that is always competing with itself to better serve the interests of this regime. And so the cathedral is the media structure that upholds the regime.
And so part of the theory here, as you describe again and again in your article, is this is all going to come crumbling down. Something's going to replace it. So let's get into that. More questions for you after a quick break here on the Reliable Sources podcast. More with James Pogue in just a moment.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon. and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Light wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back here on the Reliable Sources podcast. I'm Brian Stelter, speaking with James Pogue about his article for Vanity Fair, Inside the New Right. So there's a lot here. We could, you know, you're giving me ideas for other people I now want to interview, James. But tell me about how you approach this as a reporter, as a reporting effort, because you're really trying to unlock a world that is foreign to readers of Vanity Fair. So we talked about J.D. Vance and how you knew him and how you were able to talk to him. But how did you earn the trust of the people you were talking with?
You know, that's something that I think about a lot. Because I'm not 100% sure. And I'm not, you know, I'll be very frank. Like, I think that the way that I work, which is a little weird, but I try very much to let people talk for themselves and kind of talk at length. And I write, it's kind of old school, but I write very long pieces where ideas can get elaborated at very great length. And I tend to think that there was a part of this movement that saw me as kind of useful, and that, like, they actually think that when people hear their ideas, they're going to some degree be converted. And that's something I'm very sensitive to. That's something I worry about a lot. And I think a lot about whether or not I'm being used or played. But that said, I also think that people, just as you're talking, like, I had a personal interest in this. I think a lot of people, this was an experience I had with people reading the piece, is the first time somebody explained to me the concept of the cathedral, I just thought it was very interesting. And I think that that genuine interest kind of came across when I was talking to people. And so the person I probably thought was the most interesting to talk to for the piece was this guy, Blake Masters, who's running for Senate in Arizona. And Blake is perhaps kind of the key new right figure, even more so than Vance, in the sense that Blake is very, very unapologetic and open about using very, very kind of esoteric new right critiques. So he will critique American infrastructure and say, you know, actually, American infrastructure was better functioning in the 1970s, which just sounds weird in a room of sweater wearing Trumpy retirees. and then he will explain it, you know. And he used, this was really interesting to me. I mean, he used concepts from this guy, Curtis Yarvin, who I mentioned, you know, in a campaign event in front of a reporter, which is something that I don't think anybody, you know, heretofore on the new right has really been doing. And I tend to think that Blake thought that it would be really good to have people hear his ideas. I tend to think that he thought it would be useful. And what's interesting is, of course, on the other side, on the kind of liberal or leftist side, a lot of people thought it was really useful to hear that there was this kind of looming threat to the Republic. Yeah. So it was kind of, it was a Rorschach test, because people on the right thought that my piece was very fair. People on the left thought, oh my goodness, what is going on? I had no idea. And it really alarmed people.
Well, look, when he, the way that he talks about birth control is quite radical. However, when Masters says to you, what's victory look like? Just families, meaningful work, raising your kids and pursuing your hobbies and worshiping and, you know, there are ways that these figures can talk that sound very palatable and very mainstream until you start to scratch at it. And then you might realize how far from the mainstream it is. Is that fair? Is that totally unfair to say?
I think it's fair. I think that, though, like, a lot of how the new right works is by saying things that in 1980 sounded very normal and palatable, that now, for whatever reason, don't really fit very well into the national conversation. And so, and then Blake kind of like plays in the muddy dissonance between that. So, like, his big signature policy proposal is to kind of remake an America into a place where you can raise a family on one single salary, right? And he kind of pushes that forward, and you think, oh, great, like, let's reshape America? Definitely. That would be awesome to be able to raise a family on one salary. But it also kind of has this inflection of like, well, who is going to be the salary earner? And is
right, there's a patriarchy there. Yeah. Yeah.
And Blake will say very publicly, I mean, this is, I'm not putting words in his mouth. He says this openly. He says, you know, most of those people, most of those salary earners are going to be men. And he says that that's because, you know, men kind of intrinsically are more likely to make that choice and women are more likely to stay at home. Then you start to get into the muddiness. Then you start to get into these conversations that really do push back on a liberal vision of society, that really do push back on this kind of world we've built where, you know, women and men are expected to be equal in the workplace and equally participant in the workplace and things like that. So he knows that he's getting up to that line. He knows that he's going somewhere that people are very uncomfortable talking about. And so he can kind of do both. He can say, look, this wouldn't this be great, but also it would force us to have these other cultural conversations that make people very uncomfortable and that he is very ready and happy to have.
But where can he have them? Because you quote him talking about Fox News giving, you know, sound bites to Laura Ingraham. He sounds dissatisfied by, you know, the 2 or 3 minute live shot on cable news, even as a Senate candidate. First of all, is that true? Is Fox not the so I always think about Fox as the beating heart of the GOP, pumping blood out to all of the different arms and legs. But it sounds like that's not the case for the movement that you're describing. Fox might be a player in this new right movement, but it's not the beating heart and not for men like Masters.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I think that it's kind of the interplay between Tucker and the new right is kind of the key question there. And so, for example, the ecosystem that people are coming from of, you know, that is largely just Twitter, honestly, like a lot of these conversations are happening in like closed Twitter DM groups. They're happening on Substack, on podcasts, things like that. But Tucker is very, very much a part of those currents. And so you'll see, and like people crack up on Twitter all the time because he will quote, you know, a tweet from somebody on like a very obscure podcast, like something called like the Fed Post, that is like these kind of Gen Z young people who are kind of new right-ish. And you'll see their tweets pop up on Tucker and everybody on Twitter will light up with delight because they see that they're getting up into the mainstream. They see that it's filtering up.
Yeah, it's a wink, yeah.
But that's new. And so like even within the last 3 months, as far as I can remember, like that just started to happen and people just started to notice it. And so I think that Tucker, you know, as much as anybody else, I mean, as much as just a random guy on Twitter, I think Tucker was exposed to these currents of thought and slowly became convinced by them. And now he's playing a game where he is elevating people like Blake and JD. And just to go to your point about whether they can get these ideas out, I think they found it very frustrating in the same way that somebody from the left might find it frustrating. They get on and the easiest thing to talk about, and Blake says this, is to talk about Kyle Rittenhouse or some other kind of the touch point issue of the day. And actually, they don't get to discuss these things. They don't get to describe the cathedral and blah, blah, blah. And so Blake said to me, you know, his favorite interview he's ever done was the hour-long conversation he did with Tucker on the streaming Fox Nation site or whatever it is, because he got to get into it. And he expresses like very, you know, like real frustration because he wants these ideas to be discussed at length. He wants people to be reading books and listening to 3-hour podcasts and getting into it. But they can't really do that. And so they kind of ape the MAGA thing and hope for the best.
So maybe it's not going to be Fox, although it is Tucker's show. Maybe it is the podcasts, the Substacks. Are there any other outlets or centers of this, you know, that you see? I mean, media wise,
definitely. You know, and I wrote from the left. I wrote a cover story for this magazine, The American Conservative, which is a very conservative, very new righty magazine. And I wrote a critique of JD that they, to their credit, put on the cover. So that's one. You know, there's this new magazine, Compact. Curtis Yarvin has a very popular, I think it's a Patreon or a Substack.
But it's interesting to me, the outlets you're naming, you're not saying Daily Caller, Daily Wire, The Blaze, Red State. It's not the traditional GOP media outlets.
No, absolutely not. And you will notice, or, you know, I'm so immersed in this stuff now that I've noticed that a lot of kind of new righty ideas are filtering into those places, but it's not the locus. And credit where credit's due. This is an intellectual movement and they're intellectual people. And to a kind of shocking degree, given like how horrible our media landscape has become in so many ways, people in this world love to read very long things. They're very, very literate. They love to write long, long things that they argue about that get 3 retweets. But, you know, the American conservative, I bring that up because it's a good example. You know, that historically is this kind of paleocon magazine that now you have all these people who seem on the surface like these kind of fusty old right-wing professors at Catholic universities, very, very typical stuff. But the ideas are coming very much from this new dissident right. They're coming very much from the stuff that you're seeing on Twitter and, you know, in the Substacks. It's reshaping people across generations. At this point, it's not even just a youth movement. I think, and Tucker's a good example of that. They have convinced a lot of older conservatives that their ideas are right.
There's so much more to come on this. I'm so glad that you're opening eyes about it. Thank you for taking us along on the ride.
Thank you for having me. This is fun.
And everybody can check out the article on vanityfair.com. If you just Google James Pogue, you're going to find it right away. James, thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And that's a wrap on this week's Reliable Sources podcast. We'll see you back on television on Sunday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on CNN and always in your podcast feed. Thank you for tuning in.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.